Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Natalie Moore, and this is Reset. We've got a treat for you today. We're talking with author Margo Jefferson. The Chicago native is a prolific critic and writer who released her first memoir, Negroland, in 2015. Her second memoir, Constructing a Nervous System, came out in April. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner and has been lauded as one of the most nuanced thinkers on race, class, and feminism working today. Constructing a Nervous System is not your typical memoir. We'll get into that in a moment. Margo Jefferson joins us now. Did you plan on writing this memoir when you were writing Negroland? Because Constructing a Nervous System feels as if it is a companion.
You know, I think it is. That's true. But I was not thinking of it when I was writing Negroland. People would sometimes say to me, particularly when I finished it, well, you're going to write the next volume. And I would say, no. And then I would say, well, not in a way that kind of chronologically or just totally logically follows Negroland. It will connect with, but I'm going to want to go in some different directions, but I don't know what they are yet.
Well, let's talk about the title. You're disassembling and reassembling yourself. What does that mean for a memoir and criticism to merge?
Well, what it means, at least to me, is that the intimacies, the very personal materials of memoir, you know, your family story, confessions, you know, revelations of private emotions, they're there, but they are attached every bit as much to all of these art and media objects, a television show, a record, an artist we love, even something we've come to think of as trashy, but that we felt very influenced by. I wanted all of those kinds of experiences to be as intensely felt as, the more traditional, let's say, psychological, geographical material is, and to be felt through race, through gender, through family.
And you...
So criticism becomes very emotionally, intimately charged, and memoir takes in, all of this material around us that we tend to think of as culture, as sociology, as history, rather than as personal. But it's charged with the totally personal.
You've written that you wanted to make your way to the center of American culture and find ways to decenter it. Why?
Well, this has a lot to do with history. I came of age in the 60s and 70s. I entered high school in 1960, college in 64, and I was a young woman making her way in the 70s. That means I entered, was part of, got to witness, movements from anti-war, civil rights, moving to black power, feminism coming, the new left, LGBTQ, all of that was the stuff of the culture in an uproar and changing. And I wanted to be part of all the ways that changed the arts too, and how we feel and think. New writers, new canons, new narratives, new stories, new uses of language. And that's what I meant about, and that, that's the center of the culture, but it decentered because it was new. It was throwing challenges at the traditions that we'd all grown up with culturally, the hierarchies.
Early on in the book, you write, you must be stranded between blues singer Gertrude Ma Rainey and writer Sylvia Plath. How does that feel?
Well, it was partly a joke. I was saying, are you really stranded? or you feel you're stranded sometimes. But actually, it feels that's part of, I guess, how one reconstructs the nervous system. First, these oppositions, they're racial, they're social, they're cultural, they're class. First they can feel, I'm being forced, I'm being divided between the two. You know, they're black and white. And then, you know, you start living with them, and I end up merging Ma Rainey's lines with Sylvia Plath's. So all sorts of new possibilities, new combinations can become possible. I mean, that's also how you kind of construct a different nervous system for yourself.
And along with that, you revisit how you have felt about certain writers or musicians when you were younger. And one of them is Ella Fitzgerald and her femininity and how you felt as a child. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, she was such, with that light, beautiful, airy voice and that imaginativeness, she was always what one would think of as a kind of icon of femininity at its best, improvisational charm, surprise, lyricism, and wit. In fact, I think I compare her to some of those wonderful actresses in romantic comedies. But, you know, she could be mournful and melancholy, too. The problem for me as a vain little girl, as a vain and aspiring little girl, with all the coats, rather restrictive in terms of class and race, those codes and behavior of what was considered feminine desirability and charm and even, an authority. Her appearance threw me off. She was overweight, particularly for black women in those days to be overweight. That was like a stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
She dressed so nicely, but, you know, she could have been your school librarian or your music teacher. You know, I got everything from her singing that I didn't get from her appearances as again, this vain little girl. I guess I wanted a kind of Lena Horne glamour, right? And there she was, you know, with this genius akin to, you know, men didn't have to worry about their looks in those ways. And she had that kind of, you know, here I am, I'm going straight through it, genius. But she was still, surrounded by, weighed down by all sorts of expectations and I would say condescensions. And as a growing girl, I was participating in that.
You're also fascinated by black male performers, and you write, like a personal ad running through my head. One of those black male performers you write about is Ike Turner. Tell us more about why you wanted to focus on him, and were you nervous about including him in this book?
I was, indeed, particularly since when Tina Turner's memoir came out some years ago, I reviewed it rhapsodically for The Nation, and quite appropriately, was very hard on Ike Turner. What happens, you know, as I thought through, you know, all of these black male performers, and, you know, my generation was soul music and R&B and rock and roll. So I knew I'd have to dwell there. I found that my early adolescent, even pre-adolescent memories of his power as a performer, along with Tina's, they wouldn't leave me. Now, you know, when you're a critic, you're also some kind of susceptible fan. And I thought, well, if it won't go away, then I need to look at it because, you know, there's part of the appeal of so many black male R&B and soul singers is this mixture of seductiveness and danger and roadrunner and, you know, tender lover. And I thought, well, you know, leave out the tender and seduction or in that way. But there he is, and he was important to the music. And he helped in the initial stages. He was a talent scout, you know. He helped record B.B. King. He helped find Tina Turner. So I thought, okay, go with it. Explore it. I will also add the little personal touch. When my sister and I were first hearing Ike and Tina Turner, we were, as with every other singer's weird, trying to imitate them. And she always got to be Tina, and I always had to be Ike and the Ikeette. So I was paying real attention to her. You know,
The big sister got to be Tina.
Of course she did. Of course she did. You know that.
Well, I was also surprised that you take on Bing Crosby as an alter ego in the book.
Well, you know, there are demonic alter egos as well. And he is a kind of a white minstrel show alter ego, meaning that persona of his, you know, the movies, from the records, so full of entitlement and smooth arrogance, and that kind of fascinated me. You know, it's a entertainment form of utter white male privilege and calm. And so I thought, okay, let's just. Why, again, as with Ike Turner, why does this interest me so much? I know all the ways in which he's cornball and insufferable, and I got to, okay, it's the playing out with a kind of minstrel showboating of total calm, calm and full of itself entitlement.
Constructing a nervous system feels like you were taking writing risks, and it feels like poetry and staccato, like jazz.
Thank you.
What style or genre were you going for?
My first thought was really, let me try to do things that I haven't yet done or that I started to do with Negroland but haven't pursued, like dialogue, like changes in tone, in point of view, in jumps in time. Those aren't the kinds of things that generally find their way into criticism. So first of all, I was, you know, playing with different ways of telling a story and of revealing a self. You know, then really what kept guiding me was I thought in some ways it's going to have to be its own form, because I'm trying to merge or have a constant close dialogue between two different forms, you know, one of which focuses on art, on things of the outside world, and filters them through you know, an eye that isn't confessing anything, the other of which, you know, is saying the only reason for you to read this is because you want to know about me. So I kept having to find ways to redefine me and to jump and juxtapose.
That's all for today's episode of Reset. Be sure to subscribe for more conversations like this one. And we love getting feedback from you. So let us know what you think of the podcast by leaving a review and rating. I'm Natalie Moore. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you back here tomorrow for our weekly news recap. See you then.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.